Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
Governments around the world spending money to prop up their economies could be an opportunity to invest in a cleaner future, or not.
The United States has had one of the dirtier recovery packages. I think that's going to change under President Biden.
Also today, as Texas recovers from burst pipes from its winter storm, immigrant day laborers are largely cleaning up the mess. No questions asked.
You just get in the car. Whoever gets in the car the fastest is the one that's going to get the job, right? You don't even ask how much they're going to pay you.
And China continues its quest to crush Tibetan identity.
Posting images online of the Dalai Lama, for instance, can be an imprisonable offense.
I'm Carol Hills. We'll also look at the future of nuclear energy 10 years after the Fukushima disaster. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. All this week, we've been reflecting on the past year. The novel coronavirus has claimed 2.6 million lives worldwide. It's forced us to live socially distanced lives, keep our kids home from school, or stop going to work because offices are closed or jobs are no longer there. Across the globe, economic activity has slowed to a snail's pace, but economists and policymakers know what to do when economies seize up. Prime the pump with government spending. The latest injection, a $1.9 trillion stimulus package passed this week by Congress. The World's Anna Kusmer reports on how much of recent global spending is being used to make the world a cleaner place.
There are two kinds of government spending in the wake of a disaster. First comes rescue spending, money spent to save as many lives as possible, like for hospital beds and small business bailouts. Then comes the recovery spending to jumpstart the economy, funding that looks 10, 20 years down the road. Many environmentalists and advocates have been saying that this longer-term spending needs to invest in industries and projects that stop climate change. Here's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking in December.
The trillions of dollars needed for COVID recovery is money that we are borrowing from future generations. We cannot use these resources to lock in policies that burden future generations with a broken planet.
So far, the world's 50 largest economies have committed around $1.9 trillion to recovery spending. But a study out this week shows climate has been a small piece of the pie.
Within that $1.9 trillion, 18% is positive for their environment, meaning that 82% is not.
Brian O'Callaghan is a researcher at Oxford who authored the report. The numbers were all over the map, he says.
The green ambition ranges from someone like Denmark at 60% of spending that is positive for their environment, all the way down to someone like Australia, who spent only 2% on green initiatives as a part of their economic recovery packages.
O'Callaghan says while most countries haven't been spending enough on climate, he doesn't give them a failing grade. It's more of a warning.
We find that there have been significant missed opportunities to date, but the focus here is really on the future.
Most recovery spending has yet to happen. So while most countries are not on track right now, they could be, he says. A perfect example of a country that has potential is the U.S., says Mark Paul, an environmental economist at New College of Florida.
In rescue and stimulus packages passed to date, the United States has lagged behind significantly.
For instance, the Trump administration passed subsidies for oil and gas.
The United States has had one of the dirtier recovery packages compared to other high-income countries. I think that's going to change under President Biden.
The president is expected to propose his $3 to $4 trillion Build Back Better spending bill in the coming months, says Paul.
And that's where we're going to see the major green investment initiatives, be taken up.
It will include things like decarbonizing the electricity sector, investing in renewables, and updating transportation by boosting high-speed rail and electrifying public transit. Paul says the U.S. has a chance to get up closer to the winner's circle if this spending bill passes. Brian O'Callaghan at Oxford is hoping his study can serve as a wake-up call.
You know, we're faced with these really significant planetary crises. And we have an opportunity right now to address them while also delivering that economic growth that we're after. And we're just not doing it.
But he says we could be. With more green recovery spending, the global impact could be huge. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
In recent years, hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have fled economic chaos and political unrest back home and settled in the U.S. This week, the Biden administration told more than 300,000 of them that they can stay. Temporarily, at least, Venezuelans have been granted Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. The protection is offered to people who can't safely return to their home countries, people like Nyurka Melendez from Venezuela. She's also the co-founder of a nonprofit called Venezuelans and Immigrants Aid in New York. Nyurka, TPS is something the Venezuelan community has been pushing for, even during the Trump administration. Were you relieved to hear the news, especially for you and your family?
It was such a great news for us, and also the message that we gotten through different ways from our community, the community we work for, were really excited to read it and to hear it. There were some that people were even crying, letting us know that they were really pleased to know about the announcement. And another thing that I must say is that they felt really involved in this decision. They were messages that say, we did it, and that made us feel also even happier.
As the name implies, temporary protected status, this protection is not permanent. It lasts 18 months. Are you concerned about the temporary nature of TPS?
Yes, I am. I am really concerned about that. But let me tell you something, Carol, that maybe people is not aware about the forced migrants. At least having the knowledge that you have 18 months from now moving forward, that you can certainly plan your day by day, that is great. Because the uncertain being in a pending limbo status or in under an irregular status is just unbearable, right? It's unfair. And knowing that you have at least 18 months is good.
You and your family came here 6 years ago. What were the conditions like in Venezuela when you left?
Well, it was unbearable, but nothing if we compare nowadays. In that moment, we had to do lines to buy foods. We were in that uncertain to know whether or not we will find the right medicines. If in our case, because we had only child, Samuel, if Samuel got sick, for instance, right? So stuff like that. But in that moment, we were also afraid of our neighbors who might tell the regime or anybody who worked for them that we were against their thoughts, against their policy. So that's the scenario that we left. Nowadays, I can tell you that I know because of my family, plenty of my family is still there, and I know from them, but I'm pretty sure if I have to go back to Venezuela tomorrow, I won't recognize my own, even my own neighborhood, because everything is, of course, worse.
Did you fear for your life at that time?
Yes. When I was speaking out in a line in a supermarket, then came a guy who just threatened me, right? And I was like, okay, what is going on in here? This is my neighbor. I don't recognize you talking to me that way. And I felt that threatment such a, okay, what is going on with the people's mind? What is happening?
Do you hope eventually to return to Venezuela?
Yes, I do hope that. I hope it since the first day I submitted my asylum claim. That is a dream that I have. That is my American dream, to go back to my country and be one of the plenty of Venezuelans that we reveal, or let's say it better, build the country again.
That's Nyurka Melendez talking about the new temporary protected status that's being offered to Venezuelans living in the U.S. Nyurka, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Here's another issue concerning some immigrants in the United States: growing concerns about facial recognition technology. Civil liberties groups have been ringing alarm bells about it for some time. Now, two immigrant rights groups are suing the company, Clearview AI, arguing that their facial recognition products violate privacy laws. Sejal Zota is a leading attorney in the case and the legal director for Just Futures Law. Sejal, who are these immigrant rights groups suing Clearview, and why are they doing it?
Yeah, I mean, after the racial justice uprisings, you know, we have seen more evidence of surveillance of people who protest. The surveillance is unregulated, it's invasive, it's abusive. It has serious impacts on people who want to speak out. And our plaintiffs are all activists who have participated in various political movements, critical of the police, critical of ICE. You know, they've supported Black Lives Matter, criticized ICE and police on online platforms, and organized fundraisers for immigrants confined in detention facilities. You know, some are members of communities that have been historically over-policed and targeted by surveillance tactics.
So what is their case? What are they suing Clearview for?
So basically, Clearview is a private company that captures untold quantities of biometric data for purposes of surveillance and tracking without notice, without permission to individuals affected. It currently has 3 billion images in its database. And what they do is they scrape pictures, their software scrapes these pictures on any publicly available part of the internet, you know, social media, employment websites, and they then extract people's biometric identifiers. You know, these are like our biological and, you know, physical characteristics, immutable, unique to us, right? And they then create these face prints, you know, based on the precise measurements of our face, how far our eyes are apart, you know, how far our eyes are from our nose, things like that. And they then, you know, deposit all of that in this huge database, this huge trove, larger than any U.S. government agency has ever done, any American company has ever compiled. I mean, that's what the reports say. And then they use that as an identification tool that anyone can use in real time. And so our plaintiffs are saying that, you know, they're suing to stop Clearview from illegally acquiring, storing, and selling their likenesses and biometric data.
What about the circumstances whereby this technology is being used by law enforcement? Say one case that comes to mind is using it to identify the people who stormed the U.S. Capitol. Is that a legitimate use of it?
We think Clearview is a terrifying tool, and that because it violates people's privacy rights, it should not be out in the world.
Are there precedents for this case? Are there cities or places that have banned the use of facial recognition surveillance? And what's been the impact?
Yes, there are absolutely cities, growing number of cities that are banning facial recognition, including, you know, the Bay Area cities, you know, where this lawsuit was filed, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, Alameda. They've led that charge. You know, they were among the first in the U.S. to limit the use of facial recognition by local law enforcement. You know, and I'll note that many of these cities have passed such ordinances, right, because they've cited the disproportionate impact on communities of color. You know, for example, the San Francisco ordinance specifically, you know, cites to technologies, you know, proclivity to endanger civil rights and civil liberties and exacerbate racial justice.
Where do you think this case goes from here?
Basically, Clearview has 30 days from when they're served to basically answer our complaint or file a dispositive motion, like a motion to dismiss. You know, the next step will really be what Clearview does in the case. I mean, basically, their position is that non-consensual and surreptitious collection of people's unique and immutable biometric data is legal under all laws in the First Amendment. We obviously don't agree with that position.
Sejal Zota is a leading attorney in the case against Clearview AI, and she's the legal director for Just Futures Law. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
If you're like me, you're on the lookout for what's happening around the globe. So here's something for you. Sign up for our newsletter. You'll get our stories from our reporters and some of the latest in global news that we're following, too. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. And you're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're now 1 year and 1 day into what was officially labeled a pandemic. And scientists still have a lot of questions about this new coronavirus, including its origins. The World Health Organization will soon release a report about its fact-finding mission in China last month. That report has been quite controversial, though. The World's Alana Gordon has been tracking the situation. Alana, remind us, what was this mission to China?
So, Carol, this was a team of 10 international experts, and it was a joint effort with 17 scientists from China. And the focus has been investigating the origins of SARS-CoV-2, as in, like, what started it, what happened, where did it originate, like, from what animal. And the group put together hypotheses, diagrams, then they went in to dig into the data to see what they actually observed. And now they're expected to release their report soon on the findings. And as part of that, you know, some members have been talking from the team. They've said that the virus most likely came from animals, from bats, and then crossed over to humans from some other middle animal, maybe from a farm. There's still a lot more to fill in.
So why has it been so controversial?
There are quite a few reasons, Carol. There's a theory circulating that this came from a lab leak, but officials and those involved in the mission say it's really unlikely that this happened. But at the same time, a small group of scientists are calling for a new independent investigation. So that's one part of it. And then the other is, you know, from the start, this whole thing has been mired in politics. It reflects a lot of the tensions between the U.S. and China this past year. And it's almost become kind of a loop, if you think about it. Like, the politics create barriers to collaboration, and then the barriers fuel more political tensions. And then on top of that, this mission's been delayed for quite some time. They hit snags.
Well, what kind of delays and snags?
Well, first, it took months for the actual trip to happen. And then when the group did arrive, they had to quarantine. But then there was an outbreak. There was a resurgence in COVID cases. And in a recent seminar, even Marian Koopmans, she's a virologist and member of the team from the Netherlands, she acknowledged the frustrations.
That was a disappointment for all of us.
Their movement was really restricted, in part because of this new outbreak. That being said, Koopmans was also really impressed with the extensive studies and sampling that scientists in China had done and shared.
I feel we've gotten a much deeper understanding of the initial phase of the pandemic as it was in Wuhan.
So how have these delays impacted what scientists have learned?
Depending on how you look at it, they've impacted it and they haven't, in the sense that scientists even on the team have said it's really important to get to the source of an outbreak as soon as possible. But over time, as you learn more about the virus and how it spreads, that can also help inform the research. There's so much data to dig into with this that they're mining through. Those leading the mission have also said, don't expect solid answers from this upcoming report. All of this can take a lot of time to figure out. It's just the beginning. And even with past outbreaks and pandemics, you don't always get a full picture, ultimately.
So clearly, this trip has been mired in politics and concerns about whether this team was getting enough access to raw data to get the full picture. We're 1 year into the pandemic. What does that mean for the future?
You know, 1 year in, this has been a real moment of reckoning in global health. Understanding the origins and getting quick responses can help scientists and the world prevent future pandemics. That's been a big message. I talked with Suri Moon about what these complications of this trip mean looking forward. She's co-director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute in Geneva.
I would say these delays have really been a wake-up call that the international laws that we have that obligate countries to share information are not good enough. They're not specific enough. They're not binding enough. You know, we need stronger rules and accountability mechanisms.
And so, Carol, in a lot of ways, this has opened up an even bigger global conversation about global health governance. You know, is there a need for a new kind of pandemic treaty moving forward, as in like a new legal framework for global health? And on top of that, it points to how there's a need to build better systems for monitoring and understanding viruses in nature and animals and wildstock and that connection to humans.
The World's Alana Gordon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
This week marked an anniversary in Tibet, the 1959 failed revolt against Chinese rule. It ended with the Dalai Lama fleeing into exile. Today, China maintains firm control over historical Tibet, and its policies there have drawn a lot of criticism. That's a topic in a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Jason Palmer is the host.
For decades, the Chinese state has led a campaign against Tibetan Buddhism and its spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, whom they characterize as a treasonous separatist. The campaign has taken many forms, from propaganda published in state media to laws aiming to regulate the reincarnation of any future Buddhist leaders. But in recent months, an attempt to quash the Dalai Lama's influence over Tibetans has been stepped up even further, in a move that has worrying echoes of China's campaign to re-educate its Muslim Uyghur population.
Tibetan Buddhism is undergoing a process that the party calls Sinicization, which is essentially an effort to make it more acceptable to the Communist Party.
Gaudi Epstein is our China Affairs editor.
It's really the latest stage in a decades-long effort to crush Tibetan identity. And if any of that sounds familiar, it's quite similar in many ways to what's going on in neighboring Xinjiang, where the party is attempting to do quite the same thing with the Islamic faith. In Tibet, they're certainly not replicating the atrocities on the scale that they are occurring in Xinjiang with, you know, internment camps, with mass forced labor, with separation of children from their parents. But there are similarities with how the party is treating Tibetans, their faith, and the Dalai Lama that reflect the party's concern or insecurity about having people within its border, millions of people that have a different identity from the Han Chinese identity that the party is much more comfortable with.
But it's been clear that the Chinese state has had it in for the Dalai Lama for really quite some time. Why is it ratcheting up this pressure now?
There's a couple of reasons for that. I think one is the Dalai Lama is 85. The question of what happens when he dies is very much on the minds of the Communist Party. That will create a great period of uncertainty across the Tibetan regions. It's something they've been worried about for a long time. In 2007, they even asserted legal authority over the process of the Dalai Lama's reincarnation. So I think we should view these latest efforts as really an intensifying campaign to separate the Tibetan people from the Dalai Lama.
And in turn, bring them more under the wing of the Chinese state. I mean, very much what we're seeing in Xinjiang.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the current party boss of Xinjiang, Chen Chuanguo, cut his teeth in Tibet. He deployed heavy-handed security tactics in Tibet that he then put into place in Xinjiang. So Tibet was really a testing ground. But there are a lot of limits to this comparison I'm making between Tibet and Xinjiang. I mean, unlike Uyghurs, Tibetans can still keep in touch with people outside of China using WeChat, the very popular social media app. They don't have to fear that they're going to get arrested just for being in touch, but they do have to be cautious. Posting images online of the Dalai Lama, for instance, can be an imprisonable offense.
That's Scotty Epstein, The Economist's China Affairs editor. He spoke with Jason Palmer of the Intelligence Podcast. It's shared with us by our partners at Economist Radio. To hear more of the conversation, follow The Intelligence on your favorite podcast app. You're listening to The World.
Marco Werman here. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, but it's listeners like you from all around the globe who spinned for us and helped us exceed our goal of $100,000. These are some of our supporters who span time zones and borders to help keep the world free for everyone. Catherine Garvey, Raymond Soto, Paul Irving, Greg Parks, Nadia Shareel, Richard Schuster, Claire Crisafi, Sana Berig, Caroline Berger, and Amy Bliss. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world.
A new book set in West Africa pits Goliath against Goliath. In one corner, big oil. In the other, villagers determined to protect their land.
On the surface, it looks like it's very imbalanced. I mean, and it is. But I think that people need to realize that small African villages also have their own powers.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. When President Biden addressed the nation last night, he made a big announcement about the coronavirus.
All adult Americans will be eligible to get a vaccine no later than May 1. That's much earlier than expected.
That's great news for Americans, but in many parts of the world, the picture looks very different. A group called the People's Vaccine Alliance is calling attention to this divide. They've petitioned the president to expand access to COVID vaccines worldwide. We're joined by Robbie Silverman of Oxfam US, which is a member of this coalition. Robbie, the president says that by May 1st, all American adults will be eligible for a vaccine. How does that compare to lower and middle-income countries around the world?
Right now, wealthy nations are delivering a vaccine every second. That is an amazing achievement. But if you look globally, it's a very different story. As of last week, more than 100 countries had yet to administer a single dose. And so this really is a story of fundamental inequality. We have wealthy nations that are essentially hoarding the vast majority of vaccines, while the rest of the world is really being left behind.
So what would the People's Vaccine Campaign do to expand vaccine access?
So right now, a lot of the focus has basically been around distribution. How do we slice the existing pie of vaccines ever more finely? And we actually think that's the wrong approach. We actually think what we need to do is share the recipe so that there's enough for everybody. So there are a few mechanisms to share the technology behind the vaccines. So one is through the World Trade Organization, where more than 100 countries around the world, led by South Africa and India, have called for a waiver on intellectual property rights to allow generic manufacturing of these essential vaccines in their own countries. This would go a long way towards remedying some of the inequalities that we're seeing now and expand manufacturing.
How likely is it that these patents will be lifted? I mean, it's been continually blocked by the US, UK, you know, at the WTO. I mean, is this pie in the sky, or do you see momentum building to really make this happen?
I definitely think there is momentum building, even if it is a bit of an uphill climb. Basically, President Trump really doubled down on the sort of me first nationalistic approach and protecting the intellectual property rights of giant pharmaceutical companies. And we've definitely seen the Biden administration move off that approach. And at this recent WTO meeting, the United States, while not advancing the proposal by many developing countries, didn't express the sort of same level of opposition that President Trump did. And so I do think you see public momentum building as we recognize that we cannot block the coronavirus at the US borders. If we don't vaccinate the entire world, ultimately that's going to be hurtful here in the US and for US citizens as well.
Even if patents are lifted, I mean, would that really be enough? I mean, there is a lot of specific technical know-how required in manufacturing these vaccines. I mean, making vaccines with new technology, it's not that simple.
Some of the vaccines now do use new technology, the mRNA technology that Pfizer and Moderna use. But you actually had a former executive from Moderna speak out and say, even this new technology, he thinks facilities can be brought online in 3 or 4 months. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the Novavax vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, they're actually using vaccine technology that's been around quite a while. And so the world is actually quite good at manufacturing vaccines. Right now, it's less a matter of operational obstacles and really a failure of political will.
Robbie Silverman is an advocacy manager at Oxfam, which is coordinating the People's Vaccine Campaign to expand COVID-19 vaccine access. Thanks a lot, Robbie.
My pleasure, Carol. Anytime.
It's 10 years since the triple meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. That led Japan to temporarily shut down all of its nuclear plants. It also triggered anti-nuclear protests worldwide. Today, tens of thousands of people from Fukushima remain displaced because of the radiation. But nuclear power is a big source of low-carbon energy, and many view it as a critical part of the fight against climate change. The World's Carolyn Beeler looks at Fukushima's impact on the future of nuclear power.
The disaster was and still is most acutely felt in Fukushima Prefecture, but it changed the way just about everyone in Japan thought about nuclear power. Jeff Shimamoto's story is a good illustration of why. He and his family were living in Tokyo when reactors at the Fukushima nuclear plant melted down. The city is about 130 miles away.
I think on the fourth day, when the winds started shifting towards Tokyo, there was mass panic and hysteria.
Shimamoto says suddenly there was this overwhelming fear that radiation would seep into your house. Video tutorials on how to tape up your windows started popping up online.
It's very similar to what we're going through right now with the pandemic. We don't know where it is. We can't see it. Radiation is not something that is red and flying around in the air. And so there was sort of this panic that we had to figure out how to keep it out.
On the street, he says you weren't quite sure who you should be getting close to or what was safe to touch.
Then there was also the hoarding. You know, people were worried that, okay, well, we're not going to be able to go outside. We're going to be stuck in our home. So we got to go to the convenience store and buy all the toilet paper, and we have to buy all the milk, and we have to do all these things. And so there was this fear.
No one was killed directly by the nuclear meltdown in 2011, but the fear of radiation was pervasive. Before the disaster, he says if he thought about nuclear at all,
I was always thinking, well, if it's a low carbon footprint, that's great.
After Fukushima, he started thinking of it like this.
If it goes bad, it could kill you. It's a necessary evil, but one that I would hope would go away at some point.
Japan took all its reactors offline after the disaster, and only 9 of 54 are back up and running now. And Fukushima, like Three Mile Island and Chernobyl before it, forced people and governments across the globe to rethink nuclear power. Peter Fraser is head of the Power Markets Division at the International Energy Agency.
It was certainly the case that a number of countries put a pause on their nuclear development right after Fukushima, just to reassess.
2 months after the disaster, Switzerland announced it wouldn't build any new nuclear power plants. Chancellor Angela Merkel announced Germany would close all of its plants by 2022, heard here on the BBC.
Our energy system has to be changed profoundly. It must be safer, more reliable, and economically viable.
Global nuclear power generation didn't climb back to pre-Fukushima levels until 2019. In Western Europe and the U.S., aging power plants and opposition to building new ones means nuclear power is likely to decline significantly in coming decades. But globally, Peter Fraser says,
we think over the next decade there will be a very gradual increase. And the main reason for the increase is China.
Pro-nuclear advocates and some environmentalists believe this is a good thing, and they'd like to see more countries follow suit. Right now, more than a quarter of the world's low-carbon energy comes from nuclear power.
I used to be against nuclear power. I actually used to protest against it.
Zion Lights is a longtime climate activist in the UK.
And then I changed my mind when I realized that it's one of the bigger tools for combating climate change. So I completely changed my mind and now kind of I'm trying to undo some of the damage that I feel I might have done before as a climate activist.
This month, LICE is launching a new grassroots environmental group to advocate for nuclear power.
All the time you hear, it's a climate emergency. We need to act on it now. We need to bring down emissions now. Nuclear is our best tool for doing that.
Even in post-disaster Japan, there are people who see climate change as a threat that might justify the risks of nuclear. One of them is Toyomi Sakai McLeod. She lives near a shuttered nuclear power plant that could still pose a risk if another earthquake were to hit. That worries her, but so does climate change. She speaks to me through an interpreter.
She's never actually been to the nuclear power plant, so it doesn't really affect her. Whereas climate change, she feels that the summers are getting hotter, spring and autumn are getting shorter. So on a daily basis, she feels climate change.
The problems at Fukushima live on. It's expected to take 30 or 40 years to remove all the radioactive fuel from inside the three damaged reactors. Across Japan, opposition to reopening closed reactors is still strong. But globally, cost and competition might be more powerful factors in slowing the growth of nuclear power. Peter Fraser from the International Energy Agency says solar energy is now a cheaper option in many countries.
And I think that's something that wasn't the case a decade ago. And so as a result, when we look ahead, we see a much brighter future for renewables.
And a much more modest growth in nuclear. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
3 weeks after the devastating winter freeze in Texas, tens of thousands of Texans are in dire need of home repairs. For Houston, it was yet another destructive weather event. And yet again, foreign-born workers are playing an outsized role in the recovery. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has our story.
Hi.
Hi, Ed.
Yes.
Hi, how's it going?
Houston plumber Eduardo Dulande welcomes me into his home wearing a mask and trucker hat. A small Panamanian flag peeks out of a plant on his doorstep. He shoos away his dog, Canelo.
Hey.
Dolande's two kids, mom and wife, Mitzila Guerra, also greet me with smiles.
My wife.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Dolande says he hasn't been able to spend much time with them over the past few weeks. He's been working long hours repairing pipes. In his 21 years as a plumber, he says,
I've never seen that much damage in homes. Never.
Dolande says just in his neighborhood, he's helped around a dozen families as a favor. He says the destruction looks like something out of a movie.
It's just wet sheetrock everywhere and then all the insulation that is up in the attic, it was on the floor. And it just looked horrible.
After repairing his neighbor's homes, he came back to realize his own house had burst pipes leaking above multiple rooms. He shows me his bathroom ceiling.
I had to open holes just to fix all the leaks that I had. I also have some here.
He says his suburban Houston neighborhood was also hit hard by Hurricane Harvey, but the freeze was worse because it took people by surprise.
No power, no water. People get desperate over that.
Texas' largest insurer, State Farm, has reported more than 44,000 claims related to the winter weather. That's more than 10 times the total number of burst pipe claims they saw nationally in 2020. Immigrant workers, like Dolande, who's from Panama, are considered second responders.
As people are trying to build back, they're trying to repair their houses, they're trying to figure out how to survive the damage, immigrants are playing outsized roles in so many of the professions that are essential to Texas economy.
That's Jeremy Robbins. He heads up the New American Economy think tank. They found in Texas, immigrants make up 17% of the population, but nearly 30% of plumbers and 40% of construction workers.
If you look at drywall installers or ceiling tile installers and tapers, more than 75% of them nationwide are immigrants.
Though these immigrant workers are essential to storm recovery, many come from communities that are disproportionately impacted by catastrophic events. Rice University found nearly two-thirds of Hispanic immigrants in Houston could not come up with $400 to pay for an emergency expense. Eduardo Dolande is a citizen, but many Texas plumbers and hundreds of thousands of construction workers are undocumented, and they've become a convenient political punching bag for Republicans in recent years.
There is a crisis on the Texas border right now, with the overwhelming number of people who are coming across the border.
That's Texas Governor Greg Abbott at a press conference earlier this week. He generally sees unauthorized immigration as a threat. The governor also recently reopened the state and lifted the mask mandate.
I want to understand where his point of view was, like how we came to the conclusion that this was a good idea.
Jessica Diaz works with day laborers and other immigrant workers as legal manager for the Fe y Justicia Worker Center in Houston. She says she's concerned about lifting the mask mandate while less than 10% of the state has been fully vaccinated. During the pandemic, her organization has received nearly 400 safety and health complaints. She says day laborers who offer cheap, immediate repairs put themselves in vulnerable situations to secure work.
It's a no question kind of scenario, right? You just get in the car. Whoever gets in the car the fastest is the one that's going to get the job. You don't even ask how much they're going to pay you. You don't even ask about the employer, who they are, where they're taking you.
Diaz says their office is already investigating wage theft claims from workers who helped with winter storm recovery.
This is something that we have been seeing repeatedly since Hurricane Harvey. Houston in general is a city that is in constant reconstruction mode.
Diaz says the pattern of disaster, recovery, and abuse is all too familiar, and she doesn't see anything changing soon. Eduardo Dolande, who came to the U.S. from Panama in his early 20s, says he hopes people can see that immigrants like him, including those without legal status, are helping the city rebuild.
We are everywhere. I mean, we're helping everybody, whether they say they don't need us or they don't want to accept it. It is so obvious.
Dolande says it only makes sense for some of his hardworking colleagues to have the chance to become citizens like he did. For the World, I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
In Greece, big demonstrations against police brutality have been happening all week. They're a response to a violent incident captured on camera. The World's Lydia Amanalidou reports from Athens.
In the city considered the birthplace of democracy, protests are really common. Even during the pandemic, people have been hitting the streets of Athens to rally about everything from COVID-19 safety measures in schools to prisoner rights. Last night, activist groups converged for a mega rally. University students who have been protesting a law that'll put police on campuses linked arms and stomped through the streets, chanting, "Resistance is the only way." 36-year-old mechanical engineer Dimitris Zamouranis was there with his technicians' union. He's saying, like many in this crowd, I'm enraged at what happened Sunday. He's talking about an officer-involved incident that's thrust Greece into a week of protests. This now viral video captured by civilians shows an officer beating a man with his baton at a plaza in an Athens suburb. The man is yelling, "Why are you hitting me? I'm in pain." Officers say they were called to the plaza to check that people were complying with lockdown measures and that the man resisted. Witnesses say the attack was unprovoked. Protests erupted that same evening with demonstrators holding signs that said, "Cops out of our neighborhoods." Authorities say they've launched an investigation and that the officer in the video has been suspended. Activists say he's just part of a bigger problem. They claim Greek leaders, including the prime minister, are using the pandemic as an excuse to ramp up police presence in the streets and that police brutality is on the rise. Greek ombudsman Andreas Potakis, who heads an independent body tasked with protecting civilians, told Greek radio this week that reports of police violence are up 75% this year. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis has said little about this. His center-right party came into power in 2019, promising to restore law and order. He did make this brief TV appearance on Tuesday after one rally turned violent and a police officer was seriously injured. Mitsotakis appeared to take the side of the police, saying he was troubled by the injury. Then today in Parliament, he seemed to strike a different tone. He apologized to those who have suffered from police violence, but he quickly turned that apology into a joke. He smiled and said he'd also like to apologize for police brutality under the previous administration, now the main opposition party. He seemed to suggest he was being blamed for things out of his control. That only inflamed his critics, who plan to continue protesting this weekend. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanoulidou in Athens, Greece.
We close the show today with a story of Goliath versus Goliath. That's how Cameroonian author Imbolo Mbue describes her new novel, How Beautiful We Were. It's set in a fictional West African village where locals are facing off against a fictional American oil giant that's polluted their land and water. The company and their briefcase-toting executives are able to buy the cooperation of many villagers. Others are determined to fight back. Imbolo Mbue spoke to my colleague Marco Werman. She told him their motivation was to pass a bit of their pain along to their tormentors.
On the surface, it looks like it's very imbalanced. I mean, and it is. This is a powerful corporation. But I think that people need to realize that small African villages also have their own powers. And these villagers, their determination to hold on to their land, their connection to their ancestry, their willingness to risk everything for the sake of preserving their way of life makes them a Goliath also.
Mm. Again, this is a novel. It's a fictional corporation and a fictional village. But you did grow up in Limbe in Cameroon, a coastal town that has an oil factory. Yes. How much of this novel is an account of the world you grew up in?
Even at a very early age, when I was a young girl, I was very aware of the politics of oil. I also grew up in a dictatorship. Cameroon has had the same president for almost 40 years now. So my whole life, we had the same president. I am also Anglophone Cameroonian, and most people don't know that Cameroon is bilingual. Most Cameroonians are French-speaking, and I come from a minority that speaks English. That definitely put us at a disadvantage. So certainly, as a child, I was very uncomfortable with injustice.
So Tula, she's the young woman who leads the rebellion. She's a complex character. She's a charismatic leader. But in a society like this where tradition and religion are so important, would you find a firebrand like her? Do they exist?
Well, that is a very good point, Marco, because I have to say that when I started writing this novel, the character of Tula was more of a man. It was actually Tula's father was the person that I wanted to write about the revolutionary, and that is because I grew up in a world where most of the revolutionaries who were celebrated, the firebrands, they were men. So I'm talking about growing up in Africa in the 80s and 90s, where we were celebrating the likes of Mandela, Patrice Lumumba, Thomas Sankara, and Stephen Biko. And they were all men. So I didn't really consider that character to be a woman so much until I actually started thinking about the fact that there are women like Tula out there. We just don't talk about them as much. Their stories are not written about as much. And I really wanted to explore what it's like, not just to be a revolutionary, not just to stand up to change, but the unique prices that you have to pay as a woman to do such a thing.
Having a charismatic leader like that, leading a rebellion like this against a big American oil company, I mean, is that wishful thinking, though, a leader of any gender who can do this?
Well, that is a wonderful thing about literature, I suppose, you know, that it allows us to dream. Without giving away the story, we see what happens, you know, with her rebellion. It was important to me that I be honest in the way I portrayed everything, that even though these villagers they wanted to fight against this American oil company, even though they had such passion. It was important that I show how lopsided it was and how much not only the American oil company that was against it, but also their own government and even some people in the community who were not exactly in support of the struggle. I do think that there are lots of tulas in the world. I've read a lot about women, especially in Latin America, who are fighting against environmental destruction of their lands. So it wasn't exactly a case of being wishful that this can happen. It was more about portraying, honestly, the lives of people who choose to risk so much for justice.
I'm speaking with author Imbolo Mbue about her new novel, How Beautiful We Were. We've actually been covering the recent ruling that allows Nigerians to sue Shell Oil in Britain over oil spills. There's a similar ruling in a court in the Netherlands. What do you make of that news? Will it make a difference in Cameroon?
Yes, I was so happy when I heard it. And part of this story came from that need to understand why more wasn't being done to push back, to make these companies realize that you can't just destroy people's lands because you want to get their oil. And I mean, part of my novel was inspired by a great Nigerian activist named Ken Sarowiwa, who was murdered by the Nigerian government at the time.
Because Ken Sarowiwa, of course.
Ken Sarowiwa, that's right. He stood up against Shell and he was hung to death.
Well, Ken Sarowiwa likely inspired people like Nimo Bassi, an environmental justice activist in Benin City, Nigeria, who we spoke about recently, about the ruling in the UK. I just want you to hear this moment in our conversation. When you go to the market in Benin City, do you purchase fish from the Delta? And when you see fishmongers, what they're selling?
No. Well, you know, it's actually Benin City. You can purchase fish and hope that they're not from polluted waters. But if you go to a place like Port Harcourt, which is the oil capital of Nigeria, you would need to really be very hopeful that what you are eating is safe. Because the entire environment is so toxic, people have just resigned to just eat whatever they can lay their hands on.
It's so painful to hear him say that because it is not an easy fix. I mean, there's been so much pollution, so much degradation in the environment that you can't exactly hope that, okay, we're going to take this money and just clean the waters and then we can start eating the fish. You know, I am uncomfortable with the idea that Africans cannot get justice, you know, in their own country. They have to go to foreign courts to get justice. Mm. Even though a Western corporation comes and destroys land over there, we have to go to a court in The Hague or the UK, you know, to get the corporation to give us justice.
The motives of the villagers in this book who take on big oil, they're not pure motives or one-dimensional. What do you think the nuances are of this big oil company versus small village with lots to gain narrative? What do you think outsiders don't really appreciate about that?
Marco, we are all humans, right? African villagers are humans, and the people who work on corporations are humans. So it was important to me to not just portray a story of you know, all these wonderful African villagers, they're being treated poorly, and they're such good people, and they have this noble fight. Because, yes, they did have reason to fight, but they also had their own flaws. Tula had her flaws, like you mentioned earlier. The village head is, you know, we don't even know which side he's on. And there are many people who make poor choices. And at one point, without giving away too much, there is a use of violence. So I wanted to think about what it's like to be human and to be flawed and to be fighting for justice and to put all of your flaws within that struggle.
Imbolo Mbue's new novel is called How Beautiful We Were. It's set in a fictional African village called Kosawa, where residents take on an American oil giant. Imbolo, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
Shazam. Bangando.
A current hit in Cameroon is this track, La Niema, by Avaro Jess. It's a song that celebrates the drudgery of people working night shifts and tries to give them a sense of liberation. We'll end the show with this Jess hit. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.